Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. It's great to see people out who are interested in the operation of the federal judiciary. Couple of program notes. After the the November program was printed, we added a forum on November 30th. We printed something about it in the December forum announcement, but on November 30th, Matt Simmons, who is the leading investment banker to the oil industry and the gas industry, has just written a very provocative book about our relationship with Saudi and the limitations on the Saudi oil reserves. It's caused a real stir in the international community, and so Matt Simmons will be here on November 30th. Also, for people who are particularly interested in the operation of the Supreme Court, Jan Crawford Greenberg, who reports for on the Supreme Court for the Chicago Tribune and is a regular panelist on PBS, The News Hour with Jim Lehrer, will be here on December 16th to report on the progress towards confirmation in the Samuel Alito nomination. 11 o'clock. Okay. To consider the legacy of Sandra Day O'Connor, we are very fortunate to have Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson and journalist Joan Biskubic. J. Harvey Wilkinson really needs no introduction to the people in this room. He's the son of Richmond, a graduate of the University of Virginia Law School following his undergraduate career at Yale. His senior thesis at Yale on Harry Byrd was published as a book and is still the standard book on the political career of Harry F. Byrd. Jay went on to serve as editorial page editor of the Norfolk newspaper, was in the Justice Department early in the Reagan administration, and then President Reagan appointed him as a judge of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, where he has served since 1984. During seven of those years, he served as chief judge of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. His opinions are among the best reasoned, the best researched, and the most highly respected of all of the opinions that come out of the circuit courts of the United States. Joan Biskubic reported on the Supreme Court for the Washington Post. She is a graduate of Georgetown Law School. She is the author of several authoritative reference books on the Supreme Court, and she now is the reporter on the Supreme Court for USA Today. She has recently published a book, Sandra Day O'Connor, How the First Woman on the Supreme Court Became Its Most Influential Justice. We're going to conduct this forum today not with formal speeches. Judge Wilkinson and Ms. Biskubic will engage in a discussion. At about half past the hour, we will invite audience participation, and then at about five of the hour, we will ask them to sum up with their assessment of the Sandra Day O'Connor legacy. Please join me in welcoming Jay Wilkinson and Joan Biskubic.
It's a great pleasure to be with you. I can tell you I've admired Joan's reportage on the Supreme Court for many, many years. And she was a stellar reporter for The Post and for USA Today. And there are very few people who have followed the Supreme Court more intimately or who are more knowledgeable about all of its workings than Joan. And I just think it's a great privilege to have her here in Charlottesville. Joan, I've read your book and there's so many insights and nuggets and things it's hard for me to know where to start. But one of the impressions that I got from the book, one of the main impressions I got, which I wish you would comment on, is just the degree to which you portray Sandra Day O'Connor as a survivor. It's incredible how much she faced in her life and how much she overcame. You start with the wonderful portrait of her on the ranch, and her father, Harry Day, he liked to have things his own way, and he was very difficult. He was a very formidable man in some ways. He was quite difficult to deal with. And then she went to Stanford Law School, and she graduated number 3 in her class, and the only job she was offered was that of a legal secretary. So she was facing just what was rank gender discrimination. And then later on in her career, she had a mother with Alzheimer's disease and a husband with premature Alzheimer's disease and was dealing with that. And then she had a long bout with cancer herself. And she just overcame one thing after another, and I did all this apparently without breaking stride. And you point out, that her favorite phrases are, people would offer her sympathy or whatever, she'd just say, "Well, that's the way it is, and just deal with it." But could you, this is someone who really from start to finish just has had so much to deal with and to overcome. And what effect did that have on her?
Well, I like the word survivor. Certainly, it toughened her spirit. You know, she was the Lazy Bee Ranch. She said there was never any time to wring your hands about something. You just solved a problem and moved on. But what her background on the Lazy Bee and then being sent away to school, that was another thing that happened to her at a young age. And it was very traumatic for her. She's written a lot about the Lazy Bee, but she actually spent most of her young childhood in El Paso, where she was sent for school. And she said at one point that she hates El Paso to today, just because of how traumatic it was to leave her family. But think of that. She's born on a ranch, right, as the Depression is starting, 1930. She's sent away to El Paso. Her father was a real tough customer, as Judge Wilkinson said. But by the time she gets to the Supreme Court, she's hardened enough that when she enters this all-male bastion with where no woman had ever crossed the threshold into their secret conference, and almost all of them were at least a generation older, you know, what could they do that would really throw her? You know, she'd handled Harry Day. She had handled politics in Arizona. One thing that a lot of folks forget is that she actually, for her 24 years on the Supreme Court, was the only former elected politician who sat on the court. And, you know, as you know, Judge, that you can learn a lot from the back rooms of politics. And she brought that skill with her to the Supreme Court. And what I like to say is that it enabled her to size up the institution and in some ways to best the brethren at their own game.
One thing I was going to ask you, though, when you say about her experience in politics, Joan, politics is a lot of wheeling and dealing and trade-offs and accommodations and everything, but a court's a very different institution because we don't log roll on courts and we don't swap off cases. I mean, each case is its own universe, and you can't, I mean, it would be absolutely impermissible for a judge to say, well, if you vote this way with me on this case, and I'll vote this way with you on it. I mean, that's just the legislative process and the judicial process are so very different. And a lot of times at the Supreme Court, those are 9 little cells, and they're 9 little independent law firms, and they don't talk to each other all that much. So they communicate on paper, and legislators communicate verbally and in the elevators and everything. And you know, the Supreme Court, those little chambers are almost hermetically sealed. And so how did she manage to transfer her her political skills to a non-political, in some ways, a non-political institution. Why was she so influential?
Well, that's a good question. And a lot of people today think of politics with all the negative connotations horse trading or underhanded dealing. But, think of the broader sense of politics. Sandra Day O'Connor could come into a room and immediately work the room. She would look everyone in the eye. She'd love to meet people and to ask questions about their lives. So she comes to the Supreme Court, and she immediately tries to figure out the styles of everyone. In fact, Antonin Scalia, who had a lot of tensions with her on the law, has called her the social glue of the court. She was the kind of person who realized early on that to do the substantive work of any institution, whether it be a political chamber or a judicial chamber, you had to have some decent relations. So she starts by trying to understand her colleagues. But then the other thing she does, and this is what I meant by, she came counting votes, even though she's not trading on cases, she's watching where her individual colleagues are on a case because, face it, things aren't cut and dry, even at the Supreme Court, and there are justices who are wavering. And I found several instances where she took advantage of a justice who was on the fence and not sure which way to go and tried to maybe give him a little bit of a shove with substantive arguments, with rational arguments. So that was one way that I consider her sort of the politician on the court. Again, using that term very broadly.
Could you comment a little bit on her relationship with Justice Lewis Powell? And I say that because so many people in this room, Justice Powell was a quintessential Virginian, and so many people in this room either knew him or knew of him or know people who knew him. And I think just from a local angle, we'd all be interested in having you talk about the relationship between Justice Powell and Justice O'Connor, which you explore so, I think, sensitively in your book.
I just have so much respect for Lewis Powell and his memory. So much of this book is based on documents, the documents of past justices, and Lewis Powell's papers were especially helpful because, first of all, he kept meticulous records, and because he was a close friend of Justice O'Connor, there's a lot of material in his files from her. He first met her, actually, by paper when she was even preparing for her confirmation hearings, and she needed a place to stay, and through a mutual friend of Lewis Powell and Joe Powell, she became close to both the justice and his wife, she was staying temporarily at the Watergate. And he at first was a little bit intrigued by her and her celebrity status as the first woman justice and as this sort of youthful partygoer during the early Reagan years. And Justice Powell wrote a letter to his family saying, "The town is agog over the lady justice." But then what happened was the two of them really bonded, both because they were so mannered and civil in terms of just human relations, but also had a lot of same ideas about the law and about judging. I mentioned that for 24 years, Sandra Day O'Connor was the only former elected politician on the court, but Lewis Powell was on the school board, and Lewis Powell certainly knew how to deal with communities and think about what constituents might want for things. So I think they had some shared markers in their lives, and once they met each other, they really did form a deep bond that she benefited from. She learned a lot from him, and I think he really appreciated their deepening friendship over the years.
One of the things, Justice Powell was a very courtly, traditional man, and people were saying, well, how did Justice Powell react to the first woman on the court? And they were surprised when they learned they'd become such great friends because Justice Powell was such a traditionalist. And I said, well, if you knew Justice Powell's three daughters, you would know he would be very happy to see the first female justice. And one of the things was that Justice Powell had been a pioneer in hiring female law clerks. And as a former law clerk to Justice Powell, we go to reunions regularly, and they're women whom Justice Powell hired in the early 1970s when the other justices would not think of that.
That's
so
right.
There was a thing there. And they became so close, and one thing I've mentioned, this was a photograph which was carried across the country that they had such respect for one another and affection for one another that when the justice died, Justice O'Connor, along with his other colleagues, went to the funeral in Richmond. The justice was buried in Hollywood Cemetery, that lovely Richmond cemetery. On the way out, when they were going by his casket, Justice O'Connor picked up a lovely little daffodil, put it on top of the casket, and that was carried, and it was AP photographer caught it of Justice O'Connor placing that daffodil on the casket, and I think it's one of the loveliest moments I ever knew, and just spoke of the wonderful friendship and collegial relationship that those two had enjoyed through the years. Mm-hmm. Joan, one of the things that impressed me so about your book was the Supreme Court is a very mystical institution. It's much harder to penetrate than the Capitol Hill executive branch, which is just full of leaks. when you go up to Washington and you see the court and you see the room, and then there's red, was it velvet curtain, mm-hmm. and the justices hear oral argument, and then they all disappear behind the curtain, and that's sort of apocryphal because it indicates the sort of secrecy in which the institution is shrouded, and yet you have managed for your book to interview all but one of the justices. And that in itself is a remarkable feat because this is not, these folks don't lightly submit themselves to interviews. And it must be a tribute to you or whatever, but could you share your technique? How did you... Maybe it's asking someone like to share a recipe. No. But could you tell us how in the world you got so many of the justices to speak to you when they get requests from the media all the time and they just reflexively turn them down? How did you manage it?
Well, persistence is the main thing. As George said when he was making the introductions, I have covered the court for a while, since 1989, so most of them knew me and knew me over the years, and I had had some sort of professional working relationship with them. Some of them up and down. You know, when you work for newspapers, you sometimes get into sort of it's tense situations with your sources, and there have been tense situations with some of the justices, but what I did was I wrote to them, and as we've commented before, the court is a place where everything is on paper, and they can deal better with things in front of them on paper. And for each of them, I made a pitch for why I thought they would be so important to her story. And Chief Justice Rehnquist was the first person I went to. And as some of you know, he was at Stanford Law School with her, and then they both worked as lawyers in Phoenix and began raising their respective families there. And then they were very good friends, even dated briefly, and of course end up here at the Supreme Court together. So I started with him and then slowly worked on the others. Because I had known many of these justices from prior experiences, there were a handful who immediately said yes and didn't go talk to her, but I would say probably for most of them they did say to her, you know, Joan Biskupic is doing this book. What do you think of my sitting with her? And the line that kept coming back to me was, Justice O'Connor would say, just use your discretion, which I thought was a warning, but not a prohibition, which was wonderful. You know, this is not an authorized biography, but she could have shut these people down and she didn't. Chief Justice Rehnquist, who sat with me, did confide at one point, you know, she doesn't like that you're doing this. But then the chief, who has been subject to so much publicity over his years, a lot of it negative, said, what choice does she have? You know, she's a very important public figure, and this book was going to be done one way or another, and I feel very grateful that the justices did talk to me. And the other thing that was unusual is they allowed me to tape record them, because that's, they're often very skittish, but frankly, I felt for accuracy, it was the best way to do it, because if you're gonna have an audience with a justice, you darn well wanna get it right.
Let's talk just a little bit about jurisprudence, John.
Sure.
And Justice O'Connor has been the swing vote on so many critical questions, among them abortion and affirmative action, and the test on questions of abortion is whether a state or federal law poses an undue burden on a woman's right to reproductive choice, and the undue burden test is the one formulated by Justice O'Connor. And then on the two affirmative action, the Michigan, University of Michigan affirmative action cases, she struck down the use of race as a in terms of putting hard and fast quotas on admission, but she said it could be one of a number of factors used in a holistic review of an applicant's application. And there's been some subject to some criticism on the grounds that these tests that have been formulated didn't give clear guidance and were subject to, this was all in what was an undue burden or what was one of a totality of circumstances, that this was all left to the eye of the beholder and it would need to be litigated again and again to decide what it was, and lower court judges were going to split all over the place in applying this kind of test. And I said, we want something more in the way of clear rules and general clarity than we've gotten in our jurisprudence. And there's been this kind of criticism over the years. And what do you say about that? And how did you come down on that question?
Well, it's a very important question, and I knew I had to address it just because so many academics and lower court judges have complained. And I wanted to acknowledge that there certainly were criticisms about Sandra Day O'Connor's approach to the law. So I have a whole chapter that's essentially called Scalia versus O'Connor, because Justice Scalia is somebody who embodies the criticism on the court, at least. You know, he's somebody who likes black and white hard lines while she has shades of gray. So the way I approached it was to lay out some of these tests to show, particularly in the area of religion, where she's had a test that on issues of like the Ten Commandments or creches and menorahs in the public square. Her test is, what does the reasonable observer think? Would a reasonable observer believe that the city council was endorsing religion by putting up this nativity scene? And I let Scalia have his say. Scalia can't help but have his say. So I let him have his say through opinions that he had written criticizing her. And then I let some of the academics who have criticized her that you and I know well have their say in this book. But then what I decided to do was sort of put her in the social historical context we have now of a very polarized political scene. Certainly, Washington and Congress has been very politically divided during her time on the bench, and the Supreme Court itself has been very divided during her tenure. And look at how she is trying not to add to those divisions, but rather kind of keep her eye on the center of the country and reflect where the majority might be, where state legislators are, and because she was a state legislator, and to sort of maybe move the country a little bit, but mostly take her cues from the country. So I don't try to judge in a heavy-handed way her approach, but maybe bring a little bit more context to how her approach might have been more helpful during this time, but certainly to raise some of these criticisms, just because I do think they're legitimate. I just think that they stem from almost an academic approach of saying, why can't we have more clarity? Well, sometimes the law, like legislation, isn't always clear for all moments from here on out.
Would you think the great counterargument to the lack of clarity is, well, she proceeded cautiously, she proceeded case by case, she preferred narrow rulings, and when all is said and done, she was basically where the country was during the course of her tenure. And maybe that traces to her legislative experience that some of the justices who came to the court from an academic background were theoretical in their approach, and she came from the ranch and from the legislature. She was practical in her approach. As a former elected official, she had her pulse on where the country was going and where it was, and in the end, her votes kind of ended up where the country was as a whole.
You know, that's an interesting point, and I would say I think that is it. And I'll just use an example in affirmative action. In some of her early rulings on race-based governmental policies, she takes a pretty hard line. She thinks that, you know, the time has come to move on, to in only very discrete instances engage in certain affirmative action for past discrimination. And she says some things that make it appear that she's not going to be very favorable toward campus affirmative action. But then what happens in 2003 is that she is keeping her ear to the ground, looking at the various amicus briefs that come in from, for example, retired military officers who say our nation's military and service academies still need affirmative action, from business groups. The Fortune 500 companies submit an amicus brief saying, no, the time has not come to end this. It's important to keep affirmative action on college campuses, particularly for the law schools. And I think what happened was she would never say never on anything, and that allowed her to be open to change. And I think what happened was, in that instance for sure, is that she realized, no, that our society is still dependent on this kind of a policy, and I'm with it.
On a personal level, Joe and I ran into Justice O'Connor in the hallways of the court on a recent visit, and she was very frustrated at not being able to retire, that she'd wanted to retire, and yet it was also clear, and it's always been clear to me in conversation, that she doesn't use the word retire in the way that most of us use the word retire. I don't think that's really in her lexicon. And so I said, she really wanted a successor to be confirmed. She's been a little bit frustrated by the delay. And I said, well, what will you do? And she just went, I'm going to do this and this and this and this and this. And she had so many things. And it reminded me of how much she loved to travel, for example, how much she wanted to do that. Several summers ago, she went to Mongolia for a good part of her summer. And I said, you know, in all my parochialism, I said, why in the world would anyone want to go to Mongolia? And she said, you don't know how good the fishing is. And she's quite an internationalist. I mean, there's a great controversy about the use of international law in our domestic decisions, but she believes that the American judiciary has got to engage with third world countries and help those countries develop independent court systems that will contribute to the rule of law and the growth of democracy. And she really wants to use her quote-unquote retirement years to promote this particular interest of hers. I remember when we were putting on a conference at the Fourth Circuit Judicial Conference, and we'd have various programs, and she was nice enough to come to speak. And every time I ran into her, she would say, when are you going to put on that conference on international law? So she has so many plans. She's raring to go. And yet that they can't seem to quickly confirm her replacement. But what should we expect from Justice O'Connor in her quote unquote retirement?
Well, you've touched on many things, and I'll tell you a great story that Justice Anthony Kennedy mentioned in terms of her ability to do so much and her speed and her her sense of timing. I don't think she sleeps, actually. She's able to get so much done. But at one point, Justice Kennedy and O'Connor were on an international conference together, and the schedule said, okay, business meeting on this topic of international law from 4 to 6, 6 o'clock we do tennis, and on and on and on. Well, Justice Kennedy said was they had a very substantive discussion on some international issues, and it was just about over. And he said before he could even look up and start closing his briefcase, she was standing next to him in tennis togs saying, it's time for the tennis. So then he said once when they went to Argentina at another international conference, she insisted they all go to some tango bar at night just because she wanted to do what everybody did. And then when she came back, she insisted that John, her husband, and she take tango lessons. So she's got, you know, you cannot take her anywhere, or actually she's taking you anywhere, without her getting involved in the local culture and bringing the face of American law there. I think that she really does appreciate learning about different legal systems and cultures and wants to help other countries with theirs. Early on, as the first woman justice, she took that role very seriously as an ambassador of sorts, just domestically, to visit all the states, go speak to legal groups, speak especially to women's groups, and talk about her experience. And now, in sort of the larger global scheme, she wants to do that internationally. She's already signed up for a few things. Probably one of the more fun and interesting ones is to be the Grand Marshal of the Rose Bowl Parade this New Year's. And then she's going to be Chancellor at William & Mary, more of a ceremonial post. She's also started various judicial independence initiatives that she will focus on. She's got her speaking calendar full. I know she's going to be traveling overseas. But in the meantime, she'll decide a few more cases, probably at least until January or early February.
I would like to, at this time, try to engage members of the community in the discussion. Would those of you who have questions that you'd like to direct either to Judge Wilkinson or to Joan Biskubic, raise your hand and let Lauren get to you with a microphone. And you may address your questions to either or to both. Who would like to be the first? Don't be shy.
This question's for Judge Wilkinson. You said that Justice O'Connor's opinions were in line with the country. I was wondering if you thought that public opinion should play a role in a justice's jurisprudence.
Well, how about if I give you a very direct answer? Yes and no. No, in the sense that the justices have to follow the law, and they have to apply the law as it's written, and they shouldn't look beyond, no judge should look beyond the case at what the latest Gallup poll says. And there are times when, in the name of the Constitution, judges have absolutely got to defy what might be strong public opinion just because the Constitution charges them, number one, with being independent. And it charges us also with enforcing America's abiding constitutional values and not just transitory whims of the moment. And one can think of the classic case of Brown versus Board of Education when there was a tremendous resistance from certain quarters, but the Supreme Court held fast in its interpretation of the 14th Amendment, and thank goodness for the country as it did, that it did. But it's also very, very tricky. Because if you wander too far from the public and it can ignite a firestorm, and you can, in some instances, travel far beyond your mandate under the Constitution into areas that should more properly be reserved to the legislative process. And so the justices have a very, very difficult balancing act. On the one hand, they've got to be removed from public opinion, but they are part of our system of government, and they if they get if they're fundamentally time after time after time at odds with where the great body of the American people is, the court itself will find itself brought up short. And I think Justice O'Connor was particularly sensitive to that prospect.
Yes.
I just wanted to know, thank you. I just wanted to know if the justice being replaced has any input whatsoever, and if that person might be replaced by a person of the same sex, for example, or whether it's just something that the president himself takes on, or what is the input, if any, by Justice O'Connor in her replacement?
Absolutely zip. In fact, historically, this is a decision made by the president and then with the advice and consent of the Senate. Although I have to say, in Justice O'Connor's place, in her situation in 1981, Chief Justice Berger actually was an advocate for her behind the scenes. A man by the name of Fred Fielding, who was White House counsel to Ronald Reagan, told me that around the time that Potter Stewart secretly revealed his intention to retire, Warren Berger invited Fred Fielding over for breakfast at his house in Alexandria, served him a meal, and then just happened to mention this judge from Arizona, just to pass on the name. And he did that, and Barry Goldwater and a few other supporters tried to bring her name to the attention of the White House. Remember, Ronald Reagan had had said during his 1980 campaign that he wanted to appoint a woman. The federal bench and even state courts didn't have many women, especially Republican women, on them at the time. So this was a sort of a quiet effort. And then Attorney General William Friend Smith actually called Bill Rehnquist, who was then an associate justice, and just asked him about her. So there was some kind of interbranch conversation there. Justice O'Connor has commented about, at least she commented about her first potential successor. Remember, she's been potentially succeeded by first John Roberts, then Harriet Myers, now Sam Alito. But when John Roberts was chosen, a man who she knew because he had practiced in front of the court for many, many years, she said, well, it's just a darn shame it's not a woman. But she said that she thinks he's highly qualified. I never knew what she thought about Harriet Myers. I was very curious about what she thought of all the controversy, because I'm sure she was happy that a woman was chosen, but she might have had some concerns about sort of what was going on in terms of Ms. Myers' abilities and just the politics surrounding it. I know she knows of Sam Alito. They're not personal friends as far as I can tell, and not close colleagues as far as I can tell. And frankly, if she has some opinions, I would think she would be keeping them quiet right now.
It's a good question you raise, because although Justice O'Connor doesn't seek or have a voice in her replacement, the fact that she is being replaced is what creates such a firestorm. And that's because her position is sort of a swing vote, and also because I think that the political process has a sense of the court as maintaining a certain balance. And if a replacement threatens to shift that balance in one direction or another, then you can expect some fireworks, which is, I think, why replacing Rehnquist is maybe threatened to set off less of a furor than replacing Justice O'Connor. Replacing Justice O'Connor is a very, very hard thing in terms of the political dynamic to do.
Don Nectarline.
Do either of you see any value at all in putting an age limit on Supreme Court justices?
Well, I have to tell you that Justice John Paul Stevens is the eldest, and he's 85, and he is so darn sharp. I mean, I think it's an individual thing, and he is quite active. He still, plays golf, tennis. I've chatted with him plenty, and from everything I know firsthand and what I know from the other justices, is there's no issue there. Now, there has been issues with other justices, either because of age or illness, where they're not able to carry their weight. And that does get to be a problem. Generally speaking, though, I think it has not been a problem. And every now and then there are, opinion pieces or, public commentary about maybe there should be term limits, age limits, but it doesn't seem to be a necessary thing.
If we had an age limit, we would have been missing the services of such giants as Hugo Black and Oliver Wendell Holmes, who served into his late 80s and actually his early 90s, and Black served very productively into his mid-80s. These men and women are under such close scrutiny that if someone's not at the top of their game in a very intellectually demanding profession, it's going to be noticed, it's going to be talked about, and informally, friends and family and others will encourage retirement. I don't think the justices want to embarrass themselves. I don't think the family wants the justices to embarrass themselves. And so I tend to think these things can be worked out informally, but I feel a strict age limit, if you look back through history, would have deprived us of the services of some very able people.
Yes, ma'am. I'm going to give Lauren a good workout today.
I was personally very sorry to see Sandra Day O'Connor resign, and I understood that it was out of concern for her husband. But now I hear you talking about all the many things she's going to be doing after she retires, and so I'm wondering, why did she retire?
Well, it's different when you can choose what you want to do and when you want to do it, as opposed to being yoked to the court and the court schedule. So I think that's what she wanted, to get out from under the rigid schedule of the Supreme Court. Her official line when she announced her retirement, or her intention to retire on July 1st, was that she wanted to spend more time with her husband, John. That afternoon, Senator Arlen Specter, then at a press conference, said out loud what some of us knew but hadn't printed, was that her husband, John, had Alzheimer's. And so I think there was an interest in definitely being able to care for him. Several people have said to me that isn't there some sort of irony or strangeness in the fact that the first woman justice is probably the only one we've ever known of who would step down to take care of a spouse. And what I say is that, they were married in 52, and this was a very tight partnership. You think of what think of a man who was born in January 1930 and has a wife who goes on to be the first woman on the Supreme Court, kind of what how strong his ego had to be. He gave up a very thriving law practice in Phoenix. He was definitely a big man in town, had handled a lot of chairman of several boards and did a lot of things. He comes to Washington, has trouble setting up his own practice, in part because his spouse is sitting there on the Supreme Court, switches law firms. But yet they remain very, very close. And I think what it reflects her decision to leave is that that's sort of a real nod to the relationship that you have here, is that she wanted to spend more time with him in these later years. And even though she's doing all these things, they're sort of on her time now. She can figure out what she wants to sign up for and what the burden might be on her time and her time away from her husband. That's how I understand it.
Based on what I'm hearing and reading about the current nominee and what we've seen the actions of the other justices, does that mean there is no swing vote now on the Supreme Court?
I actually think that someone will emerge. Justice Kennedy has already been a little bit of a swing. Justice Breyer a bit himself, moving more, tends to be a little bit more liberal, but moving to the center. I don't see how, given the extremes that we have on the bench, Justices Scalia and Thomas at one end, Justice Stevens and to some extent Justice Ginsburg and Souter at the other, that there won't be a justice or two working the center. Right now it doesn't appear that Judge Samuel Alito would be that individual, and I don't think it will be Chief Justice John Roberts either. I think they'll be solidly on the right wing of the court. But it's a well-known adage of the late Justice Byron White that once you change one justice, you change the whole court. And I think what's going to happen is you'll have a lot of shifting, and each of them will find new bearings. But that's a very good question.
Cliff Byes.
Should it be a matter of concern to citizens and to the members of the court that so many important decisions are made by a 5-4 vote, that there has to be a position of swing justice? And secondly, was Sandra Day concerned? Did she feel a great responsibility and concern that she was that person?
You know, I think she was aware of the weight of her position. In fact, I was one of the people who was thinking that she might not retire so soon because of her key role and being aware of the weight of it. 5-4 decisions are tough in some ways because it does signal to America potentially that this could be a decision reversed. But there's an overriding principle at the Supreme Court, and actually it's a principle that was aired a lot during John Roberts' hearings, that principle of stare decisis, a kind of adherence to precedent. And even a 5-4 decision is precedent. And the justices themselves feel that there must be a compelling reason to back away from any ruling, even a 5-4 ruling. So, but I do think that that they do generate some anxiety when they're close like that. But every decision should be of equal weight. I mean, do you believe that too?
Yeah, I think the country is it's a really good question, and I think the fact that the country is divided over so many of these issues. When you think of the volatile things that the court handled, affirmative action, capital punishment, abortion, school prayer, separation of church and state generally, these are such volatile, difficult, divisive issues. The country is very much divided on them and closely divided, and I think it should probably come as no surprise that the court, which in some ways is reflected of the country's divisions as a whole, would be closely divided as well. There are some times, I think, when it's important that the court speak with a united voice and not a divided voice. And there were two instances that I think of where the court was able to unite that it was critical that we didn't have a 5-4 vote. One was Brown versus Board of Education. And the decisions afterwards, there was an informal rule of unanimity that prevailed on the court, and not just in the case of Brown, but in the tough years where the court was trying to assert its authority against Southern resistance to desegregation. The Little Rock school case, they worked very, very hard for a unanimous decision, not a 5-4 decision in Cooper v. Aaron, because they didn't want Governor Orville Faubus, who was and Governor George Wallace and other demagogues who were resisting the court, to be able to point to divisions within the court and to use the dissenting opinions to back up their own strategy of lawlessness. And so I think on the school desegregation decisions, for example, it was very important that the court speak as often as it could in a unified and not a divided voice. Another question where I think it was important that the court speak with as great a unity as it could within the Nixon tapes case, because there the court and the presidency of the United States were at odds, and the court was vindicating the rule of law in the sense that the presidency had to obey a subpoena. Even the president of the United States was subject to obey a subpoena and had to turn over those tapes to a court of law. But Nixon was, at the time, was exerting executive privilege and seeking to say that executive power in this situation trumps judicial power. And I think that the court had to make a response to that, and it had to speak with an institutional voice and speak with a unified voice. There are times, frankly, when I wish a unified voice would have been available. I think it was unfortunate that Bush v. Gore was a 5-4 decision. I don't say that to cast any aspersions on the majority or to cast any aspersions on the dissenters. There were obviously reasons to go both ways, and the different sides of that dispute took their views with perfect sincerity. But I think at moments of high national crisis, it would have been better for the country if the decision had not been 5-4. Other than those rare, extraordinary moments, I agree completely with Joan that a 5-4 decision, there's still a majority and there's still a minority. It's the same way as an election is. You know, there's some elections that are very close, and you may wish your candidate had won, but when the results are tallied and the results are certified, one of the great things about America is that we believe in our process, and those who lose a particular struggle show a degree of sportsmanship and recognition of our process and respect the legitimacy of the outcome. And the thing that allows us to do that is to know that there'll be another struggle on another day, and that the game at the Supreme Court is never over any more than elections in politics represent the electorate's voice at one moment, and next year or the year thereafter, there may be a different outcome. So it's really a wonderful question. And when there should be unanimity and when 5-4 matters, I guess that's the way I'd parse it out.
Let me ask Joan Biskupic if she would perhaps give us an assessment of the career of Sandra Day O'Connor. You write with great insight about her ability to act as the swing vote, as the most influential justice in trying to build consensus, build majorities on sensitive issues. Will that be what we remember Justice Sandra Day O'Connor for, or will it be for her jurisprudence?
Well, I think for starters, just the fact of being the first woman is going to be memorable and internationally known. You know, you think for almost two centuries, a woman had not crossed the threshold of the Justices' Secret Conference, and there she was at the table. And she used to say, it's not so important that I'm a woman deciding cases, it's that cases get to be decided by a woman here, that we can participate as much as anybody else, and that she's not going to decide them from necessarily a woman's point of view, but creates that opportunity. And she wrote to President Reagan shortly after her confirmation, all the speeches in the world could not have done as much as this. Because right after that, if you remember, in the 80s, the lower courts pretty quickly filled up with women too. And now applicants to law schools are half women, half male. So I think you have that. But then in terms of her legacy, we really cannot even think of any area of the law that she has not affected, and not so much just with the swing vote, but with the rationale. Judge Wilkinson just mentioned the undue burden standard for when state regulations might impinge on a woman's right to end a pregnancy. That undue burden standard is hers. On affirmative action, the standard is hers. The reasonable observer standard I mentioned for church and state, it's hers. She's been the swing vote and the person who assesses what might constitute cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment in death penalty cases. Those things will endure at least for a while. But as I said about, you change one justice, you change two justices, there will be a shakeout period. So I think we'll definitely see when history is finally written, and we have to wait to see how these things play out, that there will be a substantive impact as well as just the pure virtue of this woman who broke so many barriers.
Judge Wilkinson?
Well, I think she's going to go down as one of the really important justices in the history of the United States. And that's not just because Joan has written this marvelous, wonderful biography of her. Although most justices don't get biographies, and very few of them get biographies which are as interesting and insightful as Joan's. But I'll tell you why I think she's going to be so important. She really was what the country needed at the time. And it's what she did was extraordinary, and it's hard to appreciate, because doing the job of a Supreme Court justice is really, really hard in and of itself. And Sandra Day O'Connor was asked to do not one job, but two. As the first woman on the Supreme Court, she was in demand everywhere across the United States. What she represented, particularly in the early 1980s to women and opportunity in America, is something that you can hardly believe. And every elementary school and high school and college wanted her to speak. Every bar association sought her presence. Every academic community wanted her views because she did represent equal opportunity in a very tangible way. And if you, that this imposed a huge additional burden on her because she was asked to do these two jobs. And if you compare the speaking invitations of the ordinary justice with the speaking invitations that she got 10 times as many. They were just stacked up. And she, on her fell the burdens of meeting the expectations and interests of so many million Americans. And it's to her great credit that she tried and succeeded in doing so. And she succeeded in doing it with family illness. And as I say, even with a bout with cancer, she didn't break stride. She kept her commitment. She kept her engagement. She traveled all around trying to inspire young women. We in Charlottesville saw that. I don't know how many of you were here to hear Justice O'Connor when she came to celebrate the award of the Emily Couric Award after our late state senator. And those young women, when they received that award, and they received the awards from their schools, and Justice O'Connor was there to witness that occasion and to encourage them on, I can't tell you how much it meant to them, and you could see it in their eyes. And day after day, she was asked to do this job in addition to the job of being a Supreme Court Justice. I ask you, how many people, men or women, could have done it that well? And I think that she'll certainly be known for that. And another thing is, she stepped onto the national stage a very difficult time, and I think what she showed was she was like for many women what I think Jackie Robinson was for many African Americans. They both broke barriers, and in retrospect, it was really good that it was them. Jackie Robinson had his own extraordinary strength and way of doing things, and I think so did Sandra O'Connor. She, in one sense, she was not a modern feminist. She was a very traditional woman in many ways. She didn't push the Equal Rights Amendment in people's face. She wore very traditional clothing. Joan talks about this in her book. She fulfilled very traditional female roles at the time. She was a traditional daughter in many respects. She was a traditional spouse. She was a traditional mother. And I think what she meant to say was that women can make an extraordinary contribution to the public life of America and have an extraordinary perspective and imprint on public affairs. And you can do this without throwing overboard and jettisoning what were the traditional contributions. She managed to do in her lifetime both things. And you have to think, that's really incredible. And She was always asked not just to do one thing, but to do two things and to do them simultaneously. And I just think, you know, how lucky this country was to have had her. It could have been somebody else who would just not have grown into the role. When she first came onto the Supreme Court, I remember hearing all questions. Is she up to the job? And what they were saying was not, is she up to the job? They were saying, is any woman up to the job? Well, I'll tell you one thing. After Sandra Day O'Connor, nobody asked that question anymore. And if you ever need a testimony to her impact, that question, is she up to the job, that's gone for good.
Lauren Fenn passed me a notice. Many of you saw that will disappoint everyone in the room. No one more than it will disappoint Joan. For reasons that I'm told will be explained to me later, the university bookstore has not received the shipment of books. And I've never had this happen, so I don't really know what to do. I know many of you in the room, and I know you're book buyers, and would love to have this opportunity to get a book and ask Joan to inscribe it, which she wanted to do. We will figure out something. If you will take the little blue slip that was on your chair, if you had planned to buy a book or would like to buy a book, if you would note that on the form along with either your email address or your telephone number so we can easily get in touch with you. It may be that we'll be able to entice Joan to come back to Charlottesville for a book signing. It may be that we get boxes of books and ask Joan to sign them, and we'll deliver them to you all. One way or the other, we will not allow you all to be frustrated in this. I can't remember a day when we have had more elegant thought and more felicitous expression of that thought in this room. Please join me in thanking Jay Wilkinson and Joan Biskupic.